This is GamesAtWork.biz, your weekly podcast about gaming, technology, and play. Your hosts are Michael Martin, Andy Piper, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and are not the opinions of any organization which they have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 313, Tech Gripes. Hello again, and welcome to GamesAtWork.biz, from wherever you are listening and whenever you are listening in the world. You are very welcome. My name is Andy Piper. I've had a couple of weeks off from the show, but I am very, very grateful to be joining again this week, and I am here with my friend, Mr. Michael Rowe. How are you, Michael?
Hey, Andy, I am well. How are you? We miss you.
Oh, that's kind of you. I'm doing okay, thank you. It's been, particularly last weekend, I had a nice chunk of time off to myself, away from most things digital, or at least online things digital. So that was quite nice.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we have just a great show lined up this week, and we are missing our other Michael this week, and hope he is enjoying a little time off. And you know, with that, I think we can have so much more fun, you know, because we can do what I love doing, which is griping about tech, because I love tech. It means so much to me. I enjoy all aspects of tech, but sometimes it just rubs you wrong. And which you would think digital things shouldn't rub you at all, right? But not all tech is digital. and Andy, you actually were vocal recently about some tech that you gave as a gift.
I was vocal. I did get a little bit upset about this topic this week. So we've got a story here from The Verge.
Yes.
Which kind of this is the end of the story. It's about.
You want to take us to this point from The Verge, and then let them wrap it up nicely in a bow.
Well, so the end of the story is that a company called Cricut, which makes essentially very nice cutting machines. So you can cut vinyl and cards and print really nice designs onto heat sensitive paper and do T-shirts and mugs and stuff. They've become very well known in the making industry and in the crafting industry. They've got a range that sort of, but they're kind of like very nice consumable plotters and cutters. Earlier in the week, in fact, at the very end of last week, they announced that they were making a change to the plan. And at the moment, up until this point, you've been able to just buy the machine and then use it. And then if you wanted some additional, maybe premium features, you could pay a subscription to get access to their kind of image library and so on. But what they actually then said earlier, at the end of last week, was that, no, from now on, you'll only be able to upload 20 things to us to print on your device every month for free. And after that, you're paying us money every month.
So when you say 20 things, is that 20 images and you can print them as much as you want, or you upload 20 images and you have 20 prints?
Well, so there's a couple of weird aspects to this. And one of them is, so you have to use their software. There's no third-party software. And they're, in order to then you do things with text or what have you, there's a process between your computer and the printer. There's a process where your computer uploads whatever you've designed to the cloud, and then it comes back in some format that the printer understands. So these things have to be connected. They're useless without being on the internet or having your computer on the internet. So there's that. And so every time you make any kind of change to an item or an object, a loop in an SVG file, etc., you're doing an upload. Right
if I'm designing like one logo and I go, oh, I need to tweak that is another upload.
Yes, there it is.
So I could literally get to the point where I don't get to print anything this month, right? Because I'm still tweaking the design.
Correct. Because you'd be paying them a monthly fee to in order to have that privilege of using the machine that you'd already
of
bought.
Using the thing that you've already paid for.
So the reason I was upset was that I know a very passionate crafter, and I got one of these machines as a Christmas gift, and they've been very happy with it, and have made a bunch of cards, and the people that have received the cards have been very happy with them. And the other thing, by the way, is that you're also buying consumables from the same company, right? So the cards and the pens and the cutters and all those things are add-ons to the machine, which gets you into sort of the printer consumables sort of discussion that we've had before around DRM and so on. So you bought the machine, you're paying them for the materials, and then ideally the grand plan was that after using it less than 20 times in a month, probably, if you were a big crafter and you were selling stuff on your, you know, Etsy store or something, you're hand producing things, you're on the treadmill, you're spending that subscription. So I've got a number of friends in the crafting space, and one of them, actually, she normally makes, you know, really fun videos showing how she does, you know, talking through the process of creating art, and she teaches mixed media painting as well. But she made a very angry, upset video calling out the company and saying, you know, this is a bad change, because you're not only are you essentially forcing the community, which is it's quite a nice community. I mean, up until now, people who've bought these machines have really liked them, and you know, they've helped each other out, and that, you know, they've been quite they've been advocates for the company, you know, suddenly saying, well, yeah, you're gonna have to pay us in order to create things, not a good look. And it changed the terms of the sale, right? Because when I purchased this thing as a gift, I was buying it in the belief that it could just be used like any other thing. Once you've paid that upfront cost, you could pay for additional features. But what if you didn't need them? That's fine. So there was some consumer rights concerns there as well, I think.
Wow. So basically, to stretch the metaphor even further, they were like the razor blade company that sold you the razor, then said, hey, we're going to make a little bit more money because we're going to sell razor blades, then said, our razor blades only work with our shaving cream, and oh, by the way, we're going to charge you to grow your beard.
That's a good way of stretching the metaphor. I wonder where you were going with it, but that's not completely inaccurate. Now, there's an important element that we haven't spoken about yet, but if anybody's gone and heard this story, there's a key moment coming up for this company, which is a small thing of an IPO. So it seemed like a good time to make this change for them, I presume. The upshot of all of this is that by this time last week, as we're sitting here recording on a Friday, this time last week they made this announcement. And across the course of this week, as outrage began to spread, they've sort of gradually backed down. And they've now completely removed the need for subscriptions for ongoing use of the device. So they're now back to where they were before that.
But that's just for this version of the device. They did not discount the fact that they might come up with a new device that will be a subscription-based device, right?
Caveat emptor, always read the small print. But the point is that there was no small print until now, or until there nearly was. about it, but you're right, absolutely, they completely maintain that flexibility if they wanted to make that change in the future.
Wow. Well, you know, that's I understand the desire to make money for your IPO. The question becomes, when was it enough, right? They already had the, as you say, they had the printer and the ink,
mm-hmm.
and the paper and the print heads. They just decided they also wanted the images. Again, stretching the metaphor.
Yeah. I just, as I say, having observed this community up until the point of making my buying decision, it was clear that, you know, they're a very well-known, you know, hobbyist craft company. It seems a real shame that they've gone through that process of annoying annoying people for reasons that they possibly hadn't really thought through. So,
wow. Well, speaking of good fun tech, you and I before the show started talking about, you know, one thing that we used to like to end the show with, which is what game are you playing? And you mentioned a game that I was not familiar with, and I feel so out of the loop. I guess my WoW addiction is messing up my ability to learn about new games. And this is a series of games, the Watch Dogs games, and you've been playing Legion. So tell us a little about Legion.
Yeah, as I said, I took some time off, it'd been a game I'd been meaning to play for some time. One of the reasons is because it's set in London. Which I'll come back to. I played the first Watch Dogs, which I believe was set in Chicago. I hadn't completed it. These are open world roaming games. You play a member of an underground hacking group that are basically freedom fighters, and, you know, broadly speaking, the good guy is giving it back to the man. there was a second one, which I believe was set in, I know it was set in San Francisco. I didn't get around to playing that. And then Legion came out, and it's got a few innovations, but the key thing for me was that it is set in London, and it uses a subset of London's central London streets. It's got some really nice high level graphics and photorealism, and, you know, you can wander around iconic locations. There's a couple of sequences involving, you know, some very iconic locations that for me are irresistible because I grew up here, live here. I'm familiar with the space. It's really fun. The other thing that's cool from a sort of virtual world future tech perspective is there's this whole mechanism by which you can recruit other people to your hacking group, and as you walk around the streets, you can kind of surreptitiously sort of check them out using your device to find out, you know, whether they're pro or against your group, you know, which things might help them to be persuaded to join. You know, can you get their brother off of some kind of charge? Can you deliver medicine to some, you know, sick person? But the idea is that you assemble a legion or a small number of specialists who may have different backgrounds. Maybe they're an ambulance driver, paramedic, so that in the future if one of your operatives gets injured, they can reduce the time you spend in the hospital. The lawyer was one I got early on because I kept getting my other people arrested because I'm not very stealthy, it turns out. So he was useful.
Well, you didn't get arrested, they got arrested.
But you can also, you know, you can recruit anybody, right? So they may be a homeless person, they may be somebody with no special skills. In particular, there is one who I have who has a special skill called Doomed, and underneath the description for Doomed, it says randomly dies.
That's a special skill.
Yeah, that's basically one of, she might be really good at hacking, but at some point while you're playing her, she's just going to drop dead.
Well, that could be useful though, if you could randomly time it perfectly. You like that? and use it as a distraction for a big heist still.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, it has,
but
a...
You also, can't, because it's random.
It also has a perma... the game also has an optional permadeath feature. So, once your character is dead, they don't get injured, they're dead. That's it, they're done. You have to move on to another one that you've already recruited. He may have a totally different set of skills. It's really fun.
It's like your Doctor Who.
There's a load of stuff about flying drones or operating little hacking spider devices. It's really fun. I've been meaning to write about it. I probably will write about it because I was thinking about games set in places that you are familiar with.
Yeah.
And that whole, we've talked about this many times, that both the digital twin goal of, you know, being directly in real time, able to map a real environment onto a virtual environment. That's not what this game is doing. They've kind of schmooshed up bits of central London so that you have that uncanny valley sense of, I'm walking through this iconic location, I know what's around the next corner because I literally know this street. And then you turn that corner and it's not quite right, there's something off, but you carry around and a bit further around, you just realize, okay, they've just deleted that street over there just for gameplay reasons, right? They needed to fit more in memory or in the disc or whatever.
Yeah, that's That's one of the reasons why I'm still looking forward to getting Flight Simulator, because right. I love that digital twin yeah. aspect. Mm. Whenever I would fly Flight Simulator out of the Honolulu airport, right, on Oahu, is I would always buzz my apartment. Right, I would want to see my apartment that I had out there. Google Earth, you know, I used to have, you know, how you could generate like a tour set of videos, yeah. not videos, but like a camera. Anyway, it would jump from one site to mm-hmm. fly out, fly back down. I would do that to all the houses I lived since I was a little kid. So I could see how they look now and how the neighborhoods look now. For example, when I lived in California, we were two blocks away from this huge winter wheat field. Right, which was right next to the school, and it was always a fun place. We'd go and play there. We'd build forts out of, you know, when the crops were done, we would build forts out of stuff in the crops and everything.
Nice.
And it was fun. And now when you go there, it's thousands of homes. They've turned it into this huge subdivision.
Wow.
Homes everywhere, etc. But it's kind of nice to remember. But the school is still there. I can still see the track that I would run on.
Nice.
Right. So I love the idea of a digital twin. I love exploring those environments to have that sense of familiar yet not. So I like the idea of this, and I'll have to look. I see the link that we're going to have in the show notes has a 14 minutes of gameplay, so it'll be interesting to see that. So speaking of cool innovation, and you know, one of our topics we love to talk about here is space, the final frontier. Only there can you fly on airless bike tires. So saw this come across the feed. I actually heard about it on one of the space podcasts that I listened to. There's a company, I'm trying to find the name, but NASA developed as part of the rovers. And you see these on the moon buggies from the Apollo days, right? They didn't have regular tires. They were metal tires that were open air. They actually use a type of alloy that they called shape memory alloy, hence SMART, shape memory alloy technology, will allow a metal tire to behave like a rubber tire. So it has the flex and the give that you expect and the bounce. But it retains its shape, so it always pops back out to the regular size and the shape of it. And so this company is actually developing bike tires based off of that technology, which I just find really interesting. It was actually very timely, because I was talking to a friend of mine up in the Boston area this week who had gone out biking over the weekend, last weekend, had gotten 30 miles from home, and blew both of his tires at the same time. He didn't have two tires with him. He only had one spare with him. Blew both tires and had to call somebody to pick him up, because with this you wouldn't blow your tires.
So this, the key, as it says in the article, the key innovation here is that this alloy, this smart SMA material, actually can. It's like memory foam. It can return. Well, actually, it's the opposite of memory foam. It returns to its original shape. And it can deform to adapt to uneven terrain, potholes and so on. Obviously it's made from, you know, metal interconnected springs, so you're not going to have the puncture risk, because it's not inflated. Pretty neat technology. It looks like they're starting to do some crowdfunding and really looking at like ways that they can bring this thing to market, so that's fascinating.
Yeah, and actually, SMART is the name of the company. So it's the SMA tire, right? The what was it? Shape metal alloy.
Uh-huh.
So SMART metal, METL, is the tire. So very, very cool. I love this. You know, one of the great intangibles that is very tangible is the amount of innovation that comes out of the investment in public good activities like space exploration.
Space.
Well, you know, I'm actually going to flip an article right now that we have in our show notes. Our good buddy Michael, who's couldn't make it this today, posted an article that he saw on Ars Technica about how easy it was for a security researcher to hack somebody's carrier. And what they actually did is they swapped out they didn't do a simjacking attack.
Right.
They literally just bought a $16 prepay card and used it to forge a, what do they call it, letter of authorization,
yeah,
to swap all the SMS messages to come to their phone. And given the fact that, and I've seen lots of articles on this recently, and I've known this for a very long time, that SMS as your second factor is not very secure,
right,
because of things like this.
Right. Well, and it becomes increasingly insecure every time one of these disclosures comes out, right? So,
Absolutely. So it allowed the researcher to basically hack into all their accounts, right? And they listed a whole slew of accounts. So I was going to ask you, how do you do your second factor?
In a variety of ways. I was actually about to add a gripe.
Aha,
so one of my favorite companies, which is involved in the ABS construction industry, let's say, the plastic based brick sort of area. They have a two-factor setup which appears to require them to send me an email with my two-factor code, and that annoyed me, and I tweeted about that the other day, because it just seems a little bit, I then have to open my email app, wait for the email to arrive, find the email, somebody else could have already potentially broken into my email somehow, I don't know, it just annoyed me. I do use 2FA extensively in every place I can possibly use it. I tend to use a third-party authentication app.
Same here.
So the challenge with those is often that when you switch devices in the future, when you upgrade, those things don't always transfer easily. There are a couple of those apps that let you sort of back up your number of connections, so I don't have to go through and scan QR codes on a number of different sites every time I change my phone. But it is a challenge for sure.
Well, it's interesting with 2FA. My wife does not have a smartphone and does not want a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone that she does have, because we have such shoddy coverage here at the house, even if she were to do SMS,
mm-hmm,
it wouldn't be effective because her phone can't actually get an SMS at the house, which is usually where you're going to be asking to log into a site that gets the second factor.
Mm-hmm.
And so she actually prefers the email ones, which I do not. And because she doesn't have that smartphone, even for the ones that I use an authenticator app on my smartphone, if we are sharing access to an account, then I sometimes have to turn off two-factor so she can get in because I may not be at home.
Right.
Right.
That's a really good point, so actually.
So it's funny. I know there are more and more companies that are getting to the point where they're requiring a smartphone for you to access stuff.
Mm.
And, you know, yes, we are on that cusp of not grouchy old people, but just grouchy.
But also want to protect ourselves and our families and our friends and help them to make the right choices. I noticed a few of the apps. Steam is one of them. Facebook, Gmail, they will can send you a ping to their in-app on your mobile device, as well as another factor or change of a different type of factor to get in. When you have things like shared accounts, you know, my wife and I might both need to deal with our utility provider. And you have to then have some form of like jointly agreed login, which may or may not be very ideal. Having said that, we do use a password manager for a lot of management of a lot of these things.
Yeah, yes, so do I. And I very much encourage other members of my family to use one. I actually set up the family plan for the one that I use, mm-hmm. And enabled my parents on it, mm-hmm. Just so that, you know, they start getting used to this. I was amazed to see that Dropbox was going to start offering a free password manager.
Hmm.
And then I was highly disappointed by the fact that Dropbox is going to offer a free password manager.
Well, and actually, to some extent, this comes back to the cricket conversation, but not in any way as egregious to my mind as what happened with cricket, because that was a piece of hardware that I paid up front for with no small print. This is a new feature, Dropbox Passwords, which is already available if you're a subscriber to one of their paid plans. Same here. They're making it available to Dropbox basic free accounts, but with an arbitrary limit of passwords. Now, I know for sure that I have more than that limit of passwords on the internet across the world, in all of the different accounts I have. So this would not be an appropriate plan for me. But, you know, their argument is it might be fine for your grandparents or you know, mom-in-law who is less online than we are or has less accounts.
Well, it's so funny. As soon as I saw 50, right, I was like, for the people who aren't going to pay anyway, right? Because I know so many people who still have their, you know, 1 gig or 2 gig free Dropbox account or Meg or whatever it is. It's such a small amount that complain anytime I try to share them anything on Dropbox because they don't think about just going and downloading. And I'm like, they're the same people who are going to say, oh, cool, I can do a password manager. It only has 50. I've got 600 accounts. So I'll just put the 50 unique ones in there. And I'll just reuse them at the other 600, 540 places, which will then open up a security hole again.
But you know, the other thing that I'm thinking as we talk about this is why this pivot or why this functional add-on to their product and their service. I mean,
yeah,
every company is constantly trying to innovate, find new features that they can, you know, to add on, hopefully organically, to the product. Dropbox, boiling it down, is a multi-device file sharing app, right?
Exactly.
Now they have got other features. They've got Dropbox Paper. They've got other things, and you can pay
shared file editing.
Right, and some of those things. But I'm finding, you know, there's a lot of companies that are in similar spaces or who could add password management. Evernote would come to mind, right? I mean, why not use Evernote for managing your passwords? They can take that idea and give me credit if they start charging for it. But
they'll give it away for free for 12 passwords.
I guess it's made me a little surprised because you've got the LastPass, 1Password, some of those ones that are known like single, quote unquote, single function, or, you know, that's the core function of the product. Whereas with Dropbox, they're saying you can manage all your files, and why not put some passwords in as well? Which I just find interesting as an add-on, additive feature to the service. It's not something that immediately springs to mind to me, but then I'm not very innovative, so.
Well, it's funny because part of my grump on this one, an additional grump or gripe, is the LastPass story, because I use 1Password, and I understand that LastPass recently put a device limit on their free plan, so you can only put it on 2 devices, right? So you can have it on your mobile and your desktop.
Hmm. It's not going to work for me.
Which, exactly, because you probably have more than 2 devices, I'm guessing. Probably right in front of you right now.
Yeah, more or less. That's what I was thinking.
More or less. Yeah. I'm looking, and I think we talked about this on the show. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 CPUs in front of me right now, and all in separate containers. Mm-hmm. I don't mean a 6-core CPU. I mean 6 CPUs.
Yeah. I've been setting up a Raspberry Pi 400 over the course of the last few months for various reasons, and that's another thing I need to write about. So I want to be able to access my passwords on there. I've got tablets, iPhones, laptops, you know, the number of places where you want to have access to important information, like the ability to sign into something, is always increasing. I'm looking. I'm going to be looking for 1Password for Xbox. So I think that's the. No, I'm joking.
1Password is available for Xbox?
No, it's not. I'm joking. I made that up.
Oh.
It might be.
Wow. Because they've really done a good job of expanding. I remember when they were Mac only, and then Windows, and then I had them on Android.
I think they have a Linux beta now as well. Obviously, it's in all of the browser extensions. But it's almost not an arms race. That's the wrong word. It's always escalating. The number of places where you might want an app is often escalating because we have all these different devices. I can think of another device that we'll talk about later in the show, I guess. That will be arriving in my house soon that I might need to manage passwords in or not, depending on the gripe.
I think Michael needs it for his HomePod.
He's got the one that's just been discontinued, hasn't he?
Yes, yes.
I've got the two little ones either side of me in my office.
Oh, here. Do you have them set up for stereo?
Yeah. So I'm.
How is that?
It's really good. I'm sitting with them almost equidistant away. Not ideal positioning from a office organization perspective, but this place is a mess. But it works really well. I like it a lot. I just get frustrated. Actually, no, I've got Big Sur now. Maybe I can now stream through them from my Mac. That's interesting.
You'll have to let me know because I keep coming to the need of I need new tech.
I can see them both individually in my sound menu, but not as a pair. That's weird. I'll have to look at that. I'll do some research.
Do something. You could do something with loopback. Loopback audio would allow you to reroute them, maybe.
Mm, yeah. Oh, I'm curious.
I'm making that up. Well, speaking of Apple, recently Apple made their announcement that they were changing the percent of cut that they were taking from developers from 30 to 15%. Matter of fact, even though I charge nothing for my apps, I signed up for this because my first million, I want them only to have 15% of nothing compared to 30% of my nothing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I saw this week that Google has said, yeah, we'll do it too. not really surprised by this. From a market perspective, it makes sense to do this across the board. Initially, when the App Store was set up and when the Play Store was set up, they were building out an infrastructure to manage this type of payment processing, advertising, and distribution of apps. Maybe it wasn't 30% worth, but it was more expensive then to build it out than it is to maintain it now. So I really think dropping to 15% across the board for the first million will be a positive thing across all these marketplaces.
Well, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I mean the key element in both of these two store policy changes at Google and Apple is the whole Epic games situation, which is obviously most directed against Apple's App Store pricing policies seems to have resulted in the change there. But of course, all of these companies are going to be scrutinized over time for how much they're doing this.
And I thought after Apple did this, Epic basically said, we still don't care. We want all of it. So, and because it was that $1 million clip, Epic didn't qualify anyway after the first million, right? So I think Epic tried to pitch it as being looking out for the little guy.
Uh-huh.
No, they were looking out for themselves and they didn't get what they needed. So they're still pouting in the corner. Well, speaking of pouting in the corner, and I know we're getting close to time, so we'll speed up just a little bit. What did you think of all the things that were going to be announced next week on March 23rd?
I'm extremely excited because, of course, here's everything we know, Michael, about next year's iPhone, the one that doesn't come out till 2022. I mean, we were talking before the show about the amount of, and Apple bring it on themselves, of course, by being famously extremely secretive about their practices. But the argument here is that the latest round of disinformation, the insistence amongst many industry insiders or people involved was that there was definitely going to be a big Apple Spring event on March the 23rd, and there would be several devices that maybe revealed. And then, of course, people pile on and start speculating about other devices that may or may not be in development. The Apple Toaster, of course, was my favorite rumor for next week, and the Apple, what was it, the automated Apple back scratcher? I was pretty excited about that one, to be honest.
I think that it was that one with the built-in bidet.
Right. So, anyway, the argument or the suggestion in this article over on Apple Insider is that Apple have been operating a counterintelligence operation here and falsely letting some information be known in order to track down what was going on. So it's interesting.
And I'm actually okay that they're doing this because, you know, I enjoy Apple events where you don't know everything going in and you get some of that joy, you know, some of that surprise, some of that, you know, Christmas morning opening the package, right?
When was the last something new? When was the last one you remember? Because I'm actually thinking back now and I'm struggling to think of,
5 years or more.
It does seem a long time since, you know, there's been some genuine, like, wow surprise moment.
Even Apple One, which was sort of a one more thing, but not really, was pretty much known. It had been leaked and rumored for over a year, right?
Right, yeah.
So it takes all the fun out of it. And, you know, in both of our day jobs, we both have privileged information about what our companies are doing. And I don't talk about that publicly. I'm sure somebody would want to know. I don't know what, if I'm a supplier, it makes sense to get visibility to things coming down the pipe, right? If I'm a part of the ecosystem that's building on top of, then certain players may have the right to know. But if I'm just a consumer of a new toy or a new tech product, do I really need to know the ins and outs of every single capability that might possibly release in the next 2 years? I don't think so.
You know who else is taking all the fun out of it?
Who's that?
Intel.
Yeah. Man, you know, they were the fun guys for the longest time.
Right. Well, you can still play games on their platform, right? And you can't do that on a Mac.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so 9to5 Mac had an article on, and I saw this in a couple of different places, and you saw it other places too, right? So the old I'm a Mac, I'm a PC ads with John Hodgman and, oh God, what was the other guy's
name? Justin Long.
Justin Long.
Michael, it's literally in the title of the article. It's in your tab right now.
Yes, but I was further down in the article.
Oh, there we go.
Now you're telling out the secrets. You have leaked.
Oh my goodness! I'm taking the fun out of it.
Intel has hired Justin Long to do some Mac mocking apps against against Apple's M1 chip Macs. And what's funny is, and I haven't had a chance to watch them all, and I do plan on watching them all because I like the original ones, you know. It's almost like, to me, hiring the kid who did the Dell ads, if you're like doing a cannabis startup. go back and see if you catch that reference. dude, you're getting a Dell. I think it's great that Intel's actually doing these ads. However, let's face it, at least in the very near term, Apple has optimized their chips to really be uniquely suited directly to their market. And they have a competitive edge with their market, with their chips on their hardware. And they're taking advantage of it. And I think it's great. Intel is more utilized across different platforms, and that's okay too. And heck, I mean, Apple's still buying Intel chips for now.
But there's another element to this. I don't disagree with what you've just said, and this is, I think, the second or third time I've used that phrase in this podcast.
I don't disagree that you have used that.
I don't disagree that you have an opinion. But the other angle on this, though, is it goes back to the App Store and goes back to control and control of the platform as a whole. You know, these make points about, well, you know, because Apple has made a limited set of decisions around both policy and hardware, which is optimized for their audience and their ecosystem, therefore you can't get all of these other things that you could have if you were using one of these 15 other manufacturers' devices. You don't get some element of, I think, game streaming and things are mentioned, and or you can't use this many monitors depending on your setup, kind of thing. So I think there is a whole like control of the ecosystem aspect to it as well, and Intel's never been a full stack ecosystem company. It's been an ecosystem company. It's deliberately got its chips into as many places as possible, and that's led to flexibility.
Yeah, and like I said, I absolutely agree with that, and that's why I have, you know, an Intel Windows machine
right
sitting here under my desk. I've got Intel Macs. I do plan on getting an MX chip Mac this year.
Oh, is that what the rumor says it's called?
It's actually the MX2R73.
They're launching those on April 14th.
And that's
a big event in Cupertino.
I have reliable sources that have confirmed that. but, you know, it's what do you need? And the great thing is there are options out there. And, you know, for what I do, most of my stuff when I'm doing development is for iOS. So I'm going to use what is the most effective environment for that. And for my gaming, I have a Windows machine. So, you know.
What do I need? All I need is an iPhone that looks like a 1984 Macintosh with really low grainy res icons.
Black and white, crappy. Black and white, grainy icons.
What do you think about, this is a story on, where are we now? We're on Cult of Mac.
Cult of Mac.
We're doing a little roundup at the end here, towards the end here of our Mac and Apple stories. But what do you think about the customization options with iOS 14? I'm just not, is it 13? Which iOS are we on? Oh my gosh, I've completely forgotten. The one what you're using. The fact that you can now use widgets and change things up and make things look different. I mean, I don't do that very much. I know that a lot of people have got really excited about it. And like, look, I can have this beautifully, perfectly color-coordinated screen if I use these widget apps. I don't care.
I don't care. And matter of fact, it's funny because, gosh, many years ago, when I was primarily an OS 2 user, I could tell you how many years ago this was, there was a great company, Stardock Systems, had Object Desktop was the was the tool, and it allowed you to customize the crap out of an OS 2 environment. And they eventually ported it to Windows. You could do some Windows customization, etc. And you know, I would spend so much time building the perfect UI for myself, and yeah, it was cool for a while, but then I would change it because I would get bored. Huh? And I got to the point where I am now. I don't want to worry about playing around with the UI of my operating system. I want to be productive with the stuff on it. And this example, yes, if you're an old Mac fan from back in the day on the Macintosh, this might be a wonderful step down memory lane. But as soon as you launch any icon on that screen, you're going to be in a modern iOS environment.
Exactly. Yeah, enjoy that. Enjoy that that veneer of old schoolness for the 5 minutes that you're not in an app every day.
Yeah, and that's 5 minutes total for the entire day. Yeah. Right. Well, you've got one more piece of news that I am quite jealous of.
I'm going to add something just additional as a callback to a former show, and then we'll do my extra piece of news, and then we'll round up. But a few weeks ago, I don't know if you remember, it was either the last time or the time before that I was on the show. There was a conversation about a virtual reality show called Dream. Or a virtual production called Dream. It was being made out of the UK using motion capture and immersive technology and so on. I just wanted to make a note that I got tickets. I managed to attend it this weekend on my I was using my iPad, as it happens. It is a limited time production, so unfortunately, you kind of have to be there. But I did a short write-up about it. For those of you, our listeners, that are interested, I'll share the link in the show notes in case you wonder what you were missing. It was pretty fun. I won't say it's definitely the future of theatre and live performance, but it was really interesting to see the kind of stuff that's capable and possible when you mix realities and do so in a live way like that.
Very cool. And in the virtual performance stuff, I will also throw a link in the show notes to the operetta that I have been involved with. We normally perform in a theater, and it's an old-timey theater from the 1920s, and we have Queen Victoria up in her booth because it's Gilbert and Sullivan.
Uh-huh.
And we start every show singing God Save the Queen.
Excellent.
And so we have just released the trailer for the upcoming show, which begins with God Save the Queen. I don't like performing on Zoom, so I am a voice in the crowd. I will not be on camera because I have a face for radio.
Oh.
So
it's true, folks. He does have a face for radio.
Yes, yes. So we will throw that in the show notes for people because the first episode of the upcoming show will release, I believe, sometime end of next week.
Well, let's end on a final grump or gripe.
Yes.
And it does tie in somewhat to what we were just talking about. If I was to attend one of your shows, Michael, would I need a proprietary headset to do that, to really immerse myself in a virtual reality space?
Nope. Matter of fact, considering that most of our audience has hair of the shade blue, you might need a hearing aid. But sorry, that was horrible. That was horrible. We're trying to make it as accessible as possible across all platforms.
I am glad to hear that. Have you got anything to ask me about?
Are you doing something soon? Do you have something coming in, a new toy?
Maybe.
That might be locked into a certain platform.
Yeah, I cracked. In part because of the Microsoft Mesh stuff that Ian was on talking about a few weeks ago. In part because I already had one on order just before I managed to finally get my Series X, and I then cancelled the Oculus order. Mostly for financial reasons, I have finally cracked, and I should have an Oculus Quest 2 arriving tomorrow. So I am quite excited. Interestingly, going back to Dream, that was also optimized for multiple devices and for a broad audience, and did not require or even allow, I don't think, a virtual immersive headset. But I am quite excited. I will be able to talk with more authority, hopefully, in the coming weeks about my experiences with Oculus. We did discuss in the pre-show, and Michael was completely right to point out that it does require a certain security sign-in, which is why I'm wondering whether I can get one password for Oculus. but of course, it wouldn't matter because I'd be forced to use one single sign-in. So.
Yes, and when you log in, so when you first put it on each day, I assume you have to like a post from Mr. Z.
I'm expecting that, and possibly have to do a status update and visit several groups and doomscroll.
Doomscroll, yes. Our favorite pastime lately. Not. Well, we thank everybody for being listeners. We appreciate when you reach out to us, either on our favorite social networks, over on Twitter at games@work_biz, over on the Doom Scroll land of Facebook at our Facebook page, or over at our website, gamesatwork.biz. And if you would, do us a favor, go over to your favorite podcatching app and like us. Subscribe if you don't get every episode. It helps us. Liking and reviews will make us be exposed to more people, and we would appreciate your help on that. So thanks, everybody. And we will see you next time at gamesatwork.biz.
See ya.
See ya. You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming, technology, and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network.
and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.